Watch.
Is this where I sign up to get my medical oregano?
You don't have to sign up for medical oregano.
I don't need a medical oregano card?
The medicinal properties of oregano are well known.
I know. I heard it on WBAI.
Even so, my brother was unable to speak, could not walk. We gave him oregano.
And it cured him?
First he started to crawl.
Oh.
Then he sort of toddled.
Could he say anything?
He said da-da.
Oh.
Then mama. And then he went off to kindergarten.
And you owe it all to oregano?
No, we owe it all to WBAI.
Well, what about the oregano?
We put it on his pizza.
If you owe it all to WBAI, make sure to keep your membership current. For only $25 a year, you will enjoy all the privileges of membership, including the right to vote in WBAI's democratically run elections. And don't forget to sprinkle some oregano on your pizza.
And you're tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. The program that I just concluded is Everything Old is New Again with David Kinney. It's 8 a.m. Saturday morning, and it's time for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Stay tuned.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Or sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, a little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal. Hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Thank you, Jimmy, for starting us off on Saturday morning. It's October what? 21st. So if this is Saturday, as I've been saying every Saturday, it must be raining out. Or if it's raining out, it must be Saturday, 7 weeks in a row. Thank you, Mr. Jacobs, for filling in this morning for vacationing. Sean Rhodes, appreciate your taking the time to join us. It's at a time when the world is upside down. There were moments in my life when I thought maybe sanity would prevail. We're certainly not in that era now. Two wars going on simultaneously in the Ukraine and in the Mideast, Israel and Palestine and Hamas, at a time when America should be at functioning at full strength. The House of Representatives is in a state of, we should have a contest. What's the word that describes? Dysfunctional is the most frequently used word. I think by rejecting Jim Jordan, they showed an ounce of functional. Could you imagine Jim Jordan as Speaker of the House? Well, I feel, as I've said many times, with the two wars and with dysfunction in Washington, I feel helpless about that whole scene. And so I operate where I can think I can make a difference. And I'll give you an example. On Monday this week, the Daily News had an article which was very reflective of what I've been talking about. It said, bad year for cyclists, about to set record for fatalities, e-bikers leading the grim toll. Well, I read the article and dashed off a letter to the news, and apparently I was not alone, because 2 days later there were a whole bunch of letters in the Daily News. I didn't know anybody was still reading the news beside me, but there they were responding to this article. And I'll read you what I wrote, just since nobody read the news. And this states what my feelings are. Read your article, bad year for cyclists. The report on record, writes David Rothenberg, the report on record fatalities is tragic but incomplete. No mention is made of bikers' massive disregard for traffic safety rules. Red lights are ignored. Illegal turns on corners are epidemic. Obliviousness to bike lanes and racing around cars is prevalent, as is riding on sidewalks. All of this is a continuous danger for bikers. And then there is pedestrian peril. Walkers are constantly dodging miscreant bikers. Walk signs for pedestrians have become risky business. There are quick solutions if the mayor and the city council would get off their butts. Ticket bikers or impound offenders for 2 or 3 days, and word would get around quickly. Auto drivers obey signs because they know the consequences. Deterrence might save lives. Part of my passion on the subject comes from being hit twice by bikes on sidewalks. Will the city council respond? I don't have much hope for Mayor Adams, but he's building bike lanes and boasting about it. That's part of the story. But the bikers are ignoring the bike lanes. They go where they want, and there is no accountability and no sense of consequences. So my suggestion, while we feel hopeless and helpless about tragic things happening far away, we can have our voice heard in an arena in which we might be able to make a difference. Bikes in the city, a threat. Can we call our city council people and say, do something? They had they've had some discussion and some legislation about the e-bikes that explode and cause fires, but nothing about their violations on the streets. They are out of control. Not all, but all, you know, you only have to get hit once to know that there's a problem. That's my theory on the subject. End of discussion for the moment. You can rest assured I will be back next week or Monday. I'm live on Mondays. For a long time, they were repeating the Saturday show. I'm going to be live on Monday, and I'll probably fetch about bikes again on that day. We get you to the theater, as you know, and one of the shows for which we had tickets for the end of October, and they went so quickly, and so many people called, and I implored our friends at the New Federal Theater, please, if you can make some more tickets available for Telling Tales Out of School. It's clear to me that the BAI listeners are interested in a play, Telling Tales Out of School by Wesley Brown, directed by legendary Woody King, about four women during the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s. Well, they were in the 20s and 30s. These women gathered apparently in June of 1954. There had been a memorial service for Elaine Locke, one of the architect of the Harlem Renaissance. And after his memorial service at Abyssinian Church, I don't know if this really happened or if this is the wonderful imagination of Wesley Brown, but he takes four women, Zora Neale Hurston, of whom many of us know and have read, Nella Larsen, Jessie Fawcett, and Nancy Cunard, four women who were prominent during the Harlem Renaissance, and they're gathering together and recalling those days of artistic and political activity and inspiration. Many of the seeds which they planted flourished in succeeding decades. Well, this is all by way of saying we have some more tickets for Telling Tales Out of School. It's at the Castillo Theater on West 42nd Street. We got three pair for Tuesday, October 24th, and three for Saturday, October 28th. That's next week. That's this week coming up, isn't it? Three pair for Tuesday night, three pair for Saturday night. And we still have a couple of pair for the second week in November, Tuesday, November 2nd and Wednesday, November 8th. It's $50 to BAI and you get two tickets. So if you're new to this whole thing of ticket going via BAI, your gift makes you a member. It aids us in our fundraising. And it gives you an opportunity to celebrate and participate some of the rich cultural opportunities that exist in this city. So if you want to see Telling Tales Out of School, directed by Woody King, Elizabeth Van Dyke is playing Zora Neale Hurston. That's a plus for any show. She having done a celebrated performance as Zora Neale years ago, when I worked with her on that at the American Place Theater. She's now the head of the New Federal Theater. So your instructions are you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. You give your phone number, something that's not unanimously achieved. And then after this program, I'll call you and arrange for you to see Telling Tales Out of School next Tuesday, or this coming Tuesday, next Saturday night, and a couple of dates in November. So while you're deciding whether you want to be among the cognoscenti coming to see Telling Tales, I see the emails lighting up my computer. Fats Waller's on deck for one of his classic numbers. And when Mr. Jacobs presses a button, you will be musically entertained.
Won't you come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. I've the cutest little living room that you did ever spy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, fly.
Oh, fly.
Oh, fly.
Oh, fly.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Because you walked into his parlor, unsuspecting little fly. You should see my art collection. It's the best that gold can buy. Not to speak of my fine etchings that will surely please your eye. Oh, fly.
Oh, fly.
Bye
bye. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Oh, fly.
Oh, fly.
Because you walked into his parlor, unsuspecting little fly. You must hear my new Vic Roller, never fails to satisfy. We can play the latest music to the cue and hide the high. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Oh fly.
Oh fly.
Oh fly.
Oh fly.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Because you walked into this parlor, unsuspecting little fly. Yaddy. Yaddy. Come on out of that wheel. As a gentleman and scholar, by the spotter to the fly. After you have seen my parlor, you no longer will be shy. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Oh fly.
Oh fly.
Oh fly.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Because you walked into his parlor, unsuspecting little fly. Come out of that way.
You know, talking about Harlem Renaissance, Fats was one of the musical stars of that period. I don't know if he's specifically identified with it, but he was certainly a national treasure that emanated from Harlem in the 30s and the 40s. Graham Raymond at the Daily News singularly continues to write about correction that affects our lives. He writes in the Daily News. And in this last week, they had a story exposing something that's it's extraordinary. There's a place called the James Thomas Center on Rikers Island. I knew nothing about it. It's locked, and it's stated that it's off limits because of asbestos. Well, somebody went in and took pictures, and they found out that it's a secret lounge for correction people. Massive amount of equipment there, things that were intended ostensibly not to be determined, but obviously funding, tax funding for the incarcerated people, including mattresses, air conditioning, linens, all sorts of things that are there. It was described by one person as a rogue bunker of stolen equipment. This is at a time when the mayor and the Department of Correction dealing with budget cuts, and they eliminated programs like the Fortune Society and Osborne, which have been going in for years, running groups and preparing people for coming out and meeting them when they come out, because 50% of the people coming out of our jails and prisons are ostensibly homeless. And if there's no reentry plan, what happens is, I've said this over and over again, what one man said, we commit survival crimes to sleep and to eat with no identification, no nothing. I witnessed the programs. I sat in on groups on Rikers. I saw people coming to Fortune picked up in vans and fed and clothed and determined where they were going to sleep, so that desperation was not a part. That was cut. That money was cut. And at the same time, we read that the Department of Correction bought $90,000 worth of rifles. For what purpose? What are you going to do with rifles on Rikers Island? Are you going to shoot people? Then we read that 10 staff people from the Department of Correction, including the commissioner, Molina, did a 10-day tour of London and Paris to get information from the prisons in those two cities. I saw pictures of them standing in front of Big Ben and 10 Downing Street. Obviously, they were getting more information than they bargained for. I wonder has City Council asked them? Has the any City Council members asked them what the costs were of that trip for 10 staff people while they were cutting programs that were would have a direct effect on the safety of people on the street by providing aftercare and reentry for people in incarceration. The Board of Corrections has been ostensibly the overseer of people in on Rikers have been ostensibly banned by the commissioner. There's no accountability. They've said they will not let the press know about deaths. And it's up to Graham Raymond of the Daily News to find out. And it's easy to find out. I find out all the time. Relatives, people coming out of jail tell us the stories. They tell their relatives. The relatives call us. It's one of the reasons why Molina didn't want programs in on Rikers Island, not because they wanted to cut budgets, because outside people coming in provide accountability or ask for accountability. Where is the city on this? The mayor is useless on this issue. Where's the city council? Why aren't they asking? Why aren't they hearings? Where's the money being spent on trips to London and Paris while cutting the budget? Questions for which we should insist on answers, shouldn't we? We have more. I get so worked up, and then I want to celebrate shows. Well, this is kind of interesting. This is the last week for John Rubenstein for a stunning performance of Eisenhower. In the last 2 weeks, I have received, the BAI community. I've received at least a half a dozen letters taking me to task for celebrating a play about Dwight Eisenhower, all from people who have not seen the play about Dwight Eisenhower. Obviously, my perspective, having seen the play and John Rubenstein's stunning performance, I've said it clearly that when I was in college, I did not support Eisenhower's run for presidency. In fact, I was chairman of students with Stevenson on my college campus. And nevertheless, Dwight Eisenhower is a different cut from my impression from Republicans today. But seeing the play, as many of you have, you learn so much that we didn't know that affects what things that were happening then and things that Eisenhower was involved with, the rippling effects on our lives today. That Santayana said, if you don't know history, you're forced to repeat it. And knowing history is rich. And I think that's why this is the kind of theater that should excite BAI people. But God bless I'm not going to label them with names. God bless those that don't see a play, are convinced that Dwight Eisenhower was evil personified, and he did things of which I am in great disapproval, certainly his policy in Southeast Asia, way before the Vietnam War, could be interpreted as a factor that led to it, but not. You know, that's up for discussion. And are we allowed to discuss it? Some people don't think that there's a discussion. One man said, would I celebrate a play about Trump? I don't know if he's equating Trump with Eisenhower. I think one of the whole points about Dwight Eisenhower's place in history as a Republican is that it conveys the impression that there was a very different kind of Republican back then. Not to the satisfaction of everyone that listens to this program. In any event, John Rubenstein gives a stunning performance. He was our guest last week. His play is going to be done in Washington, and I urged on college campuses because I think history is important. And when it's coded with a theatrical adventure, it makes history that much more accessible to more people. And so I celebrate the play. And I tell you, it's in its last week at St. Clement's Theater, and we have tickets for it. You don't have to go if you think that Dwight Eisenhower was poison personified, but you should make it ease up a little bit and allow others to determine themselves where Ike stood on many things, as interpreted in this stunning production. We have tickets for Monday night at 7. Wednesday matinees are sold out. Thursday night at 5. That's a good time to go. Friday night at 7, and next Saturday and Sunday at 3. That's 5 performances in which you can see John Rubenstein. Tony Award winner, I may add, the original Pippin on Broadway, won a Tony Award for Children of a Lesser God, as Eisenhower. $50 to BAI, you get 2 tickets to see history on the stage and maybe broaden your horizon. A love. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com and maybe you'll be enlightened. Oh, my old friend, Mary Clear Heron, the late Mary Clear. What a painful thing to say, the late Mary Clear Heron. I met her when she was a waitress in a restaurant in the West Village. And I had been told by Greg Dawson of the Ballroom that this kid who was just starting out, she was going to be, they were booking her. She had done an audition. She was going to sing Monday nights at the Ballroom to fill in. And in the meantime, she, like many artists in New York, when they get started working as a waitress, and a fiery redhead with a spicy sense of humor and a beautiful interpretation of us with songs. Here she is with one of the beautiful Rodgers and Hart songs. It's from a Rodgers and Hart show called Betsy that was done in 1926. Mary Clear Heron, This Funny World.
A mop, a broom, a pail, the stuff my dreams are made of. You hope, you strive, you fail. The world's a place you're not afraid of. But soon you are brought down to earth, and you learn what your dream was worth. This funny world makes fun of the things that you strive for. This funny world can laugh at the dreams you're alive for. If you're beaten, conceal it. There's no pity for you, for the world cannot feel it. Just keep to yourself, weep to yourself. This funny world can turn right around and forget you. It's always sure to roll right along when you're through. If you are broke, you shouldn't mind. It's all a joke, for you will find this funny world is making fun. It's all a joke, for you will find this funny world is making fun of you. Of you.
Lorenz Hart's lyrics at its most ironic and sad, too. Mary Clear Harron was the vocalist on that. Before I do Out on a Limb and a little bit of business, last week I talked about my friend Hilton Webb, who has been at the castle for, did a lot of time in prison, came to the castle, got two college degrees. Even during the pandemic, he kept doing his schoolwork. It was so impressive. And he would make meetings and then say, I have to leave because I have a test tomorrow. I have to get a paper in. Very, very impressive and very moving, and watching somebody eager for a new life. Well, he's gotten his own apartment. And like many of the people who've come through the castle, there are some grants and whatnot to get furniture. But it's an expensive proposition to move for anyone. 1 month rent, 1 month security, agent fee. And he's been working. And he said, suddenly he's paycheck to paycheck. And I said, well, that's, you know, while many BAI people are listeners, the BAI community, I've challenged folks in the past, because while we're waiting to change the world, maybe we can make the difference in one life. And change their world. And many of the, and about two or three times we've done this. We got a man whose pants were ruined. His only pair of pants were ruined. We got him pants so he could go to work with dignity. A woman who came through Fortune, an intern who had never had an apartment. People responded. So with Hilton, I said, you know, there are things that you're going to need. Mops and sheets and pillowcases and all the, well, he told me a lot. I asked him to make a list, and a lot of things he was not aware of. You know, how many tins of Ajax do you think you're going to need? Well, I can tell you, I'm always getting a new roll of Bounty and a new rubber, you know, a scrub brush. You need, that costs money. And so I've asked people to respond, and a couple have. Several emailed me. He's heard from a couple. But if you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, I'll tell you how to get in touch with Hilton. He can tell you what his priorities are, and you can tell him how you can help if in any way. He heard from someone, a listener in Ada, Michigan. Thank you, Greg. Isn't that nice that somebody out there responded? You don't even know that people, you don't even know that Michigan's there. And then there it is. It's very touching to me. Very. And the young woman, Christina, who BAIers housed 5 years ago, I've told this story. I ran into this beautiful, beautiful young woman at Fortune who was a court advocate, and I thought she looked familiar. And I thought, oh my goodness, that young waif of a 5 years ago has her own apartment, and she's got a great job, and she looks like $1 million. And she always tells me how important it was. You know, Thomas Jones got the 17 pair of pants, and it was a dialogue on a Thursday meeting at the Fortune Academy, and Joanne Page was prodding him relentlessly about, he was angry about his pants being ruined and wanted to, you know, talked about, well, I should have done this and that. And she kept asking him, and what's more important, your pants or your freedom? And he kept defending his, quote, manhood. And then when we presented him with the pants, all provided by BAI people, Joanne wisely said to him, your pants were ruined by strangers and it got you angry. How do you feel that you got pants from strangers who don't even know you and heard your plight. An interesting challenge that he had to deal with. And TJ, who later went into the play The Castle, referred to that. And he said that incident, he said to himself, well, maybe, just maybe, I have a chance. And the BAI community was part of that. Don't minimize the reaching out to one person. We can protest and march today and tomorrow about the evils and the horror of what's happening in the Middle East and the Ukraine. But I don't know how much, well, I guess it's important for people to hear their voices heard. But you can really make the difference in the world of someone here at the same time. I failed to mention, you know, we've been offering tickets at the Joyce for the Sankei Juku Dance Company from Japan, which is a homage to Japanese dance theater. And of course, you've heard me celebrate the Joyce over and over again. And I suddenly realized we still have a couple of pair of tickets left for it. For this Tuesday night at 7:30, the opening, and then the following Tuesday night, October 31st, Halloween night. So there are two pair of tickets left for the Sankei Juku. And it's $60 for two tickets. And if you are so inclined to be aesthetically inspired, I invite you to email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your phone number and we'll get you to the Joyce, where the world is beautiful. It's athletic and graceful. Dancers out on a limb. America has always had a foolproof Head Start program, which has had little to do with funding tots in inner cities. White heterosexual Christian males were given the edge, a head start, ever since the founding fathers gathered in Philadelphia in 1776. And add to that, before legislation bestowed it with a name, affirmative action was part of the nation's modus operandi. College admissions and employment opportunities, two of the most obvious components afforded to white heterosexual Christian males from here on in, will be referred to as the WHCMs. Affirmative action was afforded to them. That facet of American life plowed along for years, decades, for two centuries, unchallenged. Add to that, holding political office, and you have the story of America in its first two centuries. In recent years, the declining advantage or the exclusive edge of being a WHCM might have gone unnoticed a little longer if Donald Trump had not come along, because the core of the slavish acceptance of a monumentally flawed accused felon is wrapped up in the realization that privilege and opportunities had to be earned, not automatically presented because you're a WHCM. It might well have been that another man, one not named Trump, would be called upon to restore that which was presumed and fading. But Trump's arrival on the scene with the credentials of a TV reality show host was the perfect storm. He has been knighted and obeyed, and they have been rewarded by being known as the base. The anger and the resentment has been boiling. Unfulfilled dreams of unfulfilled men, incapable of reflecting on their own limitations. They are witness to the rise of the others. Television stories celebrating others in beautiful homes while they're living paycheck to paycheck, overlooked, not hired, sharing resentments in barrooms, collecting rumors about the others. They have become injustice collectors. Sporting events are an important part of the masculine measuring rod in America. Watch the spectator outbursts at NFL games. They look like a dress rehearsal for January 6. As early as 1947, Jackie Robinson was perceived as a threat, an omen. but not nearly as harrowing as seeing an entire starting lineup of an NBA team boasting only black men, all stunning examples of manhood. And the best white players seem to be imported from other countries, immigrants, also others. And then you see attractive white women, often seen on the arm of a black athlete or a black entertainer, creating no small amount of rage. I was once sitting with a group of men watching a game on television. An attractive white woman in the stands was identified as the wife of a back player. And one of the men muttered to me, "They all go for the white woman." And I looked at him for a second and I said, "Did it ever occur to you that she had a say in it and she might have preferred a black man?" He growled at me and stormed out. The white woman, the ultimate possession of the WHCM, historically placed on a pedestal, alternately protected and abused. And along came Barack Obama, elected twice as president of the United States. Not only that, but recognized as the smartest man of every room he entered, the most inspiring political speaker of our time, respected and praised by world leaders, and he was handsome and black. Trump the vulgarian, a proven serial liar, an accused rapist and tax fraud, was the antidote for the base. That's not my observation exclusively about the tapestry in motion. Let me cite the comments of a character in a new novel, the fictional sociologist reflecting author Daniel Schwerenbecker's views. He writes, quote, "The fragility of white masculinity is a real thing. This is a demographic that has always occupied the highest stratum of society, financially, politically, and socially. And while people don't like to admit it, social change is a zero-sum game. The gains of other demographic groups comes at a cost to those perilously advantaged. The velocity of change has been brutal to white men. The moment we're in is of great leveling. The playing field is becoming more level for many marginalized groups, and all the built-in advantages of white masculinity being rendered moot or worse, toxic. And it is no surprise how these men are reacting. They are a group with the least practicing managing setback, the least institutional resistance to hardship." End of quote. I agree with much, but not all of that observation. Not all. But to be clear, the perceived fears are not singular. It's racial. It's also about gender. And it's about sexual orientation. And you have the basis for the perfect storm, a response of irrationality and self-defeating. Every time a black man, a woman, or a gay person is celebrated for their sex, success, or achievements, the unstated response from WHCM is, "Why not me?" January 6 was a clear demonstration of uncharted, mindless, violent protest, more a revelation of machismo gone amok than a challenge to the election process. Trump challenged the buried rage, giving it a false justification. But that rampage was about much more than Trump being denied a presidency he lost by 7 million votes. It was about the demasculinization as perceived by the base. Of course, this is not a profile of all white males. Any glimpse of the business section of most newspapers will show you photos of corporate CEOs and CFOs, governors and senators, still money, mostly WHCMs. Other faces are evident, a black person here, a woman there, and oh my God, there's an openly gay Pete Buttigieg in the president's cabinet, Secretary of Transportation. No wonder the Proud Boys are protesting a man in a dress reading Aesop's fables to children accompanied by their mommies. That's their definition of a threat to the children, not guns or violence or bigotry, but a fable by Aesop. I am a white male, but not with full credentials, being Jewish and gay, but these perceived impediments are invisible, which results in my spending a great deal of time in those closed dens of maleness, presumption, and privilege, part of the DNA. I've observed the knowing nods of resentment and disapproval and of the erosion which is personalized. This is rarely stated overtly, but seeps out in various ways. Restrictions and voting choices, the most apparent. The WHCM is always defining and distorting those who are black or female or gay or an immigrant, among others. Is there a way out of this self-destructive, no-win situation, phase four, WCHMs? I'm always hopeful it might begin with more than a few self-assured men of remarkable talent to recognize the virtues and the advantages of partnering with the others to release the heavy baggage of hate, which often implodes. To know that the plantations are not going to be brought back and to expose the exploitations and irrelevance of hucksters with their own pathological needs. To be led by charlatans is a walk off the plank into an abyss. I have many thoughts on the subject, but it needs a sit down or many sit downs with men unthreatened by change to provide options and minimize irrational fears, to meet and to know the others. Let's face it, there's nothing harder to alter than a tough guy who is afraid and doesn't or can't face it. But to be less fearful of change is a start. Who wants to travel that path? It might take a real man to say, I'm not afraid to face my fears. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. And here's Joe Cocker to sing to you.
Baby, let me be, 'cause you don't care. Well, please set me free. Unchain my heart, baby, let me go. Unchain my heart, 'cause you don't love me no more. Every time I call you on the phone, sometimes set me free.
Thank you, Joe Cocker. Big sports fan that I am, part of my male credentials. I don't apologize for it. People often say, why are you watching games? I love them. I was a sports writer, first job I had. Love watching the games. This week, baseball, basketball, and football all at once. I was in heaven. Today, Ohio State, Penn State. That's a biggie. But the best thing I saw all week was an exhibition game, spring training or whatever you call it, fall training, fall, autumn training. The Warriors, Golden State against Sacramento. Golden State was down by 18 points, and I love watching it because Stephen Curry gives me joy watching him. And with about a minute left, he makes a three-pointer and makes them 2 points behind. And then with 5 seconds left, they bring the ball in, and the announcers were saying, are they going to go for two to tie it or three to win? And Curry, the quintessential clutch player, with 5 seconds left, makes a three-pointer. And the Warriors win by one. One of the most exciting games, even though it doesn't mean anything because it's an exhibition game. What I loved about it, it was an interview with Stefan, who really is a sports treasure, was interviewed, and they said, why didn't you go for the two for the tie? It's a much safer bet than the three that won the game. And Stefan said, I had to get home and put the kids to bed. Ain't that wonderful? It was also that I was watching one night going, you know, with the remote, baseball, the Phillies in Arizona, some football game replay, basketball, and then I was watching the Liberty in their fourth game, and watched much of the first quarter, and they're ahead by 7 or 8 points. And I said, well, they'll tie it up at 2-2, and then we'll see what happens in the fifth game. And then when I switched in the end of the third quarter, they were losing, and the Aces beat them by a couple of points. But, you know, I'm not a great WNBA fan, but I'm a New York supporter, and I do like watching the Liberty. And I don't think they should apologize. I think they had a good season, and they represented the Big Apple very well. So good for you. Better than Jim Jordan is representing the people of Indiana. What a mess. You know, there's a song in Carousel called You're a Queer One, Julie Jordan. And I kept singing, You're a Strange One, Jimmy Jordan, that they would even consider him to be Speaker of the House. So the Republicans are futzing around trying to figure out. I would love it. You know, the leading vote getter, if you watch the tally, is the Democratic nominee, Hakeem Jeffries from Brooklyn. Now, would four or five Republicans go over? And that's all he needs is about five votes. That would be five less for the Republicans and five for him, so that the country could function again. Could it matter to make the country function again during this crisis period? No, that's not going to happen. Republicans aren't going to do that. Would the Democrats do it? No. Will five Democrats vote to have somebody reasonable? Well, I don't know. Let's get you to the theater. The Ode to the Wasp Woman. Wasp Woman. Many of you have responded when I first announced it last week. It's a new play starring Sean Young, who had a great run in the movies 20 years ago. She was a leading lady to Harrison Ford and Blade Runner, and to what else was she in? She was opposite Kevin Costner, No Way Out, and she was in Wall Street with Michael Douglas, leading roles in all of them. She's doing a play called Ode to the Wasp Woman. There are four actors in it, all playing B players from movies. If you're an old movie buff, you will remember names like Susan Cabot, George Reeves, Alfalfa, everybody remembers him from Our Gang, and Barbara Payton. Is she of ample blonde hair and mammary glands, as I recall? Sort of a fourth-rate Marilyn Monroe. Anyway, these are the characters, in Ode to the Wasp Woman. Very interesting. You know, actors don't start out to be jokes in bad things. They settle sometimes and they make a living at it, and then they become camp. So Ode to the Wasp Woman chronicles the lives of four B-movie stars, their desperate and sensational events that lead to, I guess, the downfall of fallen stars, with each one telling their story. It's described as a veritable homage to film noir and true crime. Ode to the Wasp Woman. It sounds like my kind of play. A preview start next Monday, not this Monday, next Monday. So we have tickets for Monday night. The Wednesday matinee, you've already snapped up. Thursday, November 2nd. Saturday matinee, you've snapped up. And we have Sunday matinee, November 5th at 3 o'clock. And then the whole following next week, which includes matinees on Wednesday and Sunday. Ode to the Wasp Woman. It's at the Actors Temple on West 47th Street. I love, you know what, DCM sometimes has these clinkers. God, Joan Crawford was on about three of them this week. One worse than the other. You know, my friend Julie Halston says that she slaps somebody in every movie. So I wait for the slap, and I blinked my eyes during She Was a Dangerous Woman, and I heard the slap, but I didn't see it. Joan's a big slapper. Anyway, if you want to see Ode to the Wasp Woman, I think we have one pair left for the Joyce. Two pair. Tuesday, October 31st. No, that's it. Two pair. Tuesday, October 31st, Halloween night at the Joyce Theater for the Japanese Dance Company. I guess, Mr. Jacobs, now let's play that song from A Day in Hollywood, and that will lead into, and you can call our guest, Foster Hirsch. And I'm really looking forward to talking with him about his book, Movies of the 50s. So let's hear from the original cast in A Day in Hollywood, A Night in Ukraine, a musical homage to movies. And then we'll talk to Foster Hirsch.
A colossal architectural sensation. From the plush of your seat in the Grauman's Chinese Theater, life can be as plush as your imagination. So if pure entertainment's your style, descending the stairs, hundreds of girls doing high kicks. Just go to the movies, just go to the flicks.
And over the sum of a quarter, life is peachy. You can become Alice Faye or Donna Meachy.
Swooped with your bills, late with your rents. Watch Betty Davis run out on George Brett. Dark and upset, go calling on Clark and Claudette.
Just go to a marvelous
afflicts vicariously. You are flying down to Rio.
Share the marquee with Mrs. Marx's zany trio. So when your life seems a bit lean, just let some shadows appear on the screen. Shine like a star for a brief while. Whenever you're down in the dumps, try putting on Judy's red pumps. Just go to a marvelous movie and smile. So when your life seems a bit lean, just let some shadows up on the screen. Shine like a star for a brief while. Whenever you're down in the dumps, try putting on Judy's red pumps and visit a gun toting Sharpie. On the Harpia, dangerous beauty, Cupid, all cutie, and ancient Hylama. I step in mama, just go to the movies and smile.
It's Forster Hirsch with us. Yes, no? Mr. Jacobs, have we reached Forster Hirsch?
Yes.
Forster, are you there?
I am. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, good. Yeah, let's turn off the music. I introduced you with that wonderful song from Jerry Herman, A Day at the Movies. Could you hear any of that?
Yes, I could.
That perfect intro to you. Your book is a feast. Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, published by Knauf. And, you know, when I first heard, I said, well, you could pick any decade, but there's a reason so much happened in the 50s. And while I was aware of it, I didn't put it all together. And you've done it so skillfully. I guess the first thing to say is why the 50s was the crossroad for American movies. And the first subject is television came in. Is that the right
yes.
start, do you think?
That's a very good start, because television was a real threat to the movies. The movies in the 40s during wartime, unparalleled attendance, box office, through the roof. And then after the war, the studios took a big hit. Fewer people started going to the movies on a regular basis, and the studios had to reinvent themselves in order to bring back the audience, and they never brought back the audience at the same level as during the wartime. Attendance has been on a decline ever since, relative to what it had been at its height. So the threat of television unnerved the entire Hollywood filmmaking establishment.
And then you write about the death knell of the studios. The studios went, television was part of it, but also actor and agent power.
That was a big part of the death of the studio. Lew Wasserman at Universal in 1950 negotiated for his client, James Stewart, an unprecedented contract. He would get a percentage of the grosses of three films. Two of the films were failures. He didn't get anything. But the third film was an unexpected success, Winchester 73. And James Stewart had an unprecedented payday. Don't you think other big actors wanted their agents to negotiate the same contract with the studio, a percentage of the gross? And the moguls were infuriated, because they saw the signs that if that continued, the old studio system would be threatened and might very well perish, which is what happened. And along with, do you remember the consent decree?
Which is what?
The consent decree was also known as the Paramount decree. That
oh yes, the, yeah, yeah.
Yes, where the studios were accused of being in restraint of trade because they made films, they distributed films, they produced films. They had a monopoly. The studios had to get rid of their chain of theaters, and so Warner's had to sell Warner Theaters. United Artists had to get rid of its theaters, Fox, and so forth. That meant independent producers could negotiate for the best theaters, and the studios were not assured of booking their films into their own theaters. That was called block booking.
So, Foster, let's go back before the 50s. You make it clear that there were men that really ran Hollywood, the studio heads who became legendary, Jack Warner, Louis B. Mayer, Zanuck, Selznick. They ran it, but their movies were terrific. I mean, would you just look at the movies of 1939? So while it was considered a great advance for the independents to come along, when you look back at it, these tyrants really made good movies, didn't they?
Absolutely. That's an important point that I wanted to make in the book. They were not perfect men by any means. They certainly could be tyrannical and difficult. Their sexual history was certainly anything but immaculate. They had one thing in common. They loved movies. So many people in the post-studio system are businessmen, and it's just a product for the tyrants that you're talking about, the old school moguls. They had a deep commitment to their movies, and they felt they represented the popular taste of the time.
They did have a flaw, and you talk about we've always heard of the casting couch. Starlets would be bedded and have a part, but it was more. People like Zanuck and Herbert Yates, maybe you can tell us about, they didn't just have casting couches. They built whole film careers on bedmates. Vera Haruba Rolston was a running joke, but Herbert Yates kept her going, well, didn't he?
He did to their detriment. They tried to promote their mistresses, and then in Herbert Yates' case, his wife, to the position of being a star. But Vera Ruba Ralston, a joke to people of certain age, if they know the name, was in many ways responsible for the death of Republic, because Yates, he built his movies around her. The audience didn't take to her. She was Susan Alexander Cain before the fact. He thought she was terrific. The audience didn't buy her. And he stubbornly kept on, and she was the highest paid employee until the end of Republic Pictures, 1957-1958.
Now, Zanuck was a great producer, but he had Bela Darvey and Juliette Greco.
And somebody named Jean-Pierre Gilles, who made one movie, Hello and Goodbye, and it was goodbye to her. But you know what, with Zanuck, that was just a very small part of his total output. And with Herbert Yates, he put forward his wife as the star of his studio. For Zanuck, it was just a few projects here and there, and his mistresses didn't become stars in America, and he moved on. That didn't destroy him. But Vera Ruba Ralston was important in the destruction of Republic.
Foster, what I loved about the book, Hollywood and the movies in the 50s, is you started writing, I suddenly read about something, I said, well, I saw them, I remember that, but I didn't realize in context. Television came in, the studios were going out, and then you have a whole section on Cinerama, CinemaScope, something called VistaVision, which I even saw, and that was all ways of getting people back in because they were losing their audience. So it was the start of technology. And I thought of that because Ben Mankiewicz recently on TCM said, the movies under the studios were about plot and character. But once the studios folded, it was about special effects and finding demographics, movies for a specific audience. Who plotted all of that and all of that with the Cinerama and the CinemaScope, and did it pay off?
Only one of them paid off. Cinerama was actually begun by people who were outside the industry. None of the industry moguls wanted to take it on. It was too expensive, and the screen was too large to tell stories, so you could only have travelogues. I saw them as a kid, and I loved them. But they never became a model for filmmaking. The technology of Cinerama was too expensive and too cumbersome. you needed projectionists. It was very difficult. And as a matter of fact, now people have to take my word for what this Cinerama was. It cannot be projected in any theater in the world. Cinerama is a lost technology. And then there was 3D, which had a very brief vogue from 1952 to 1955. People laughed at the films. Some of the films are better than their reputation, but 3D got the reputation of being a gimmick. People didn't like wearing glasses.
They were always throwing something at me.
Well, and I enjoyed that, but some people didn't like having to duck.
I was ducking. But two other things happened.
Yeah, but the third technology did change the industry. CinemaScope, which was presented by Daryl Zanuck and Spiros Gouras at Fox, was a widescreen process, but it wasn't as big as Cinerama. The screen was enlarged, and there was more space on the screen, and it was a new way of showing movies. I thought the widescreen and the widescreen technology that was developed was a terrific answer to television, and it got people out of their homes because the TV screens in those days were tiny. You went to the theater, and the screen opened and opened and opened, and you had this great vista in front of you. It was a new filmmaking style and vocabulary, and it's with us still. That was successful.
But you know what's funny about that? Yesterday, A Star Is Born, the Judy Garland, James Mason version, was on TCM, and at the beginning it says, in CinemaScope, but on the television screen, it doesn't mean much, does it?
It doesn't mean much, but it's playing at film form. For our series there, you know, 50 from the 50s.
Tell us about that. What is that?
50 from the 50s is a program I co-curated with the great programmer Bruce Goldstein. It's at the Film Forum as we speak. It started on October 13th. It goes for 4 weeks, and then there's a fifth week of only Hitchcock in the 50s. That was his most creative period. 7 Hitchcock masterworks are being shown that week. So we have 5 weeks of great movies from the 50s seen in proper ratio, widescreen, and a number of 3D films are being screened, and the 3D films are selling out. So the young
Are you going to be at any of them for discussion?
I'm going to be at a number of them. Yes, I am.
So we have to people have to check and say, when is Forster Hertz going to be it, so they can be there?
Coming Wednesday, I'm interviewing Gary Cooper's daughter, Maria Cooper Janis.
Oh, say hello to her for me, please.
She's wonderful. And Carl Foreman's daughter, Amanda Foreman, about High Noon.
Do you know that Maria Cooper was on the board of directors of the Fortune Society years ago? Isn't that there's a little nugget for you.
There's a nugget, and she's a wonderful philanthropic person to this day.
And a lovely woman. Married to was she still married to Byron Janis? He passed
away,
I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No,
but what happened in the 50s is when you talk about movies that I took for granted, but there's a reason for them. They were the religious epics, the little movies, the Martys, and then Foreign Houses opened. Those were all answers to the change, weren't they, to the demographic?
Very much so. In the late 40s, a group of theaters opened, and they came to be known as the art house circuit. And they showed independent American films and important films from abroad because there was an explosion of foreign filmmaking in the post-war period. Japan and Italy and France and England, extraordinary foreign films. The only one of those theaters left in Manhattan is the Paris, which is the final single-screen theater left
doesn't the Film Forum sort of plays that kind of a role, does it not?
Absolutely. The Film Forum is the best.
Well, that's when we were introduced to Kurosawa and Fellini and Bergman and Truffaut. Those were the four biggies.
Absolutely. But the Film Forum repertory is, these are revivals, but theaters like the Paris and the Fine Arts showed Kurosawa when he first came out.
Yes.
So now it's in revival.
The religious epics were very popular, The Robe, The Ten Commandments, and they all used the widescreens, didn't they?
The Robe was the first CinemaScope film, and it's the film that saved the industry. The big joke, however, is that the original script of The Robe was written by Albert Maltz, who was one of the Hollywood Ten.
Yes.
brought up on charges because he was a communist. And he infiltrated a communist point of view into the robe. And the Christians in the robe are really surrogates for communists in the 50s. They meet in secret cells. They're a threat to the state. The emperor wants a list of names of all of those who are joined to this new and dangerous creed.
And almost every actor in Hollywood had a role. There were no bit, you know, bit players. You know, I'm watching and I said, oh, I didn't know Susan Hayward knew Jesus. Oh, there's Mary Astor. They were all there.
But I'm in the minority. I have a soft spot for the big biblical epics. I know that for many people, they're not serious filmmaking. They don't like them. It's not the taste of today, the epics, and they don't make them anymore.
But I didn't know this about you. You were growing up in California. Was your family in the film business, or were you just one of those kids that went every Saturday matinee?
My family, they were dedicated moviegoers. So lots of.
But were they in the business?
No, no.
So you didn't know these folks?
No connection to the business. They loved movies. They took me and the neighborhood kids to the movies, and that's how I got to like movies. I thought, gee, I love this.
Now, when you write a book about the decline of the studios in the 50s, and that's the centerpiece, who's around? Is it all research, or did you find people helpful that you talked to that survived that period? I know that at one point you were talking with Carol Baker. I don't know why I remember that. And she was Baby Doll. But who were there other actors and directors?
Not only at one point was I talking to Carol Baker. I'll be talking to her again after a screening of Baby Doll at the Film Forum on November 2nd. And she is one of the few survivors of the period, and she's quoted throughout the book about Warner Brothers and about the challenges of making movies in the studio era. She was at the end of that era. But over the years, I've interviewed a lot of people for AFI and different venues. So in my acknowledgments, you'll see a list of famous actors and writers and directors to whom I spoke over the years, and I use quotations from those interviews throughout the book. So that's an attempt to introduce contemporary witnessing. Plus, I'm old enough to say I saw most of these films when I was a kid, and so I am myself a witness to the period.
Well, but Forster, clearly having seen it, but becoming a historian and putting it all in perspective, who were the people of that period that gave you the clarity of what happened? It didn't just occur to us that televisions, there must have been people from the industry who told you that this is what happened. Who were those folks?
Well, the people who were there, who were under contract to the studio system, talked to me about the threat of television. But that's a matter of the history books. That isn't something that is original research.
But who did you talk? I want to get the names of who had an impact.
You want a list of names?
Yeah, I'm like Joe McCarthy.
Yes.
No, I don't want a list. I want to know. Who influenced you about what you've done? Is for a movie buff like me, it's delicious. I just couldn't get enough of it. But it's also a history book. If there are college classes on the history of cinema, this will be a textbook as well. Obviously, there were people.
That.
You know, it wasn't Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine. They were Zanuck, Preminger, who.
Well, they were gone when I was doing the research, so I did depend on secondary sources. I did a lot of reading, but the focus of the book, David, is my own reaction to the films. It's a history, as you say, but it's a very personal history. It's about my movie-going experience, and then I put that into a larger cultural and historical context. But it's very much about me going to the movies what I thought about the movies then and what I think about them now. So it's sort of like a portrait times two. I look at myself as a younger film goer and how I reacted to the films. And then I look at myself now. Writing the book, I kept meeting younger versions of myself. It's very much about me, my opinions, what I thought about the movies, my reaction to 3D and CinemaScope and the new actors, and based on talking to some of the survivors and reading.
Well, and much of it resonates with a reader like me who went through that period also. Your chapter on women's movies, what you call The Weepers, in which personified by Lana Turner and Susan Hayward and a lot of Joan Crawford,
yes,
movies like I Want to Live and Imitation to Life, the corny, I didn't even know Douglas Sirk had come, the man who had made them. I was always fascinated that Lana Turner, every room she walked into, her outfit matched the furniture. The color scheme.
Perfect color coordination.
Perfect color coordinations. But they were, you know, I knew they were corny, and yet I liked them. Why?
Well, Douglas Sirk, you mentioned that name. Douglas Sirk has undergone a greater critical reevaluation than any other filmmaker of the time. At the time, as you say, his films were very popular. Magnificent Obsession, There's Always Tomorrow, Written on the Wind, triumphantly, Imitation of Life, Tarnished Angels. They were big box office successes. They were called weepies, but they weren't taken seriously. They were dismissed as, quotes, women's films. But over the years, they have been taken up very seriously as containing all kinds of levels of content. And they're the subject of academic evaluation and conferences. They are double and triple texts. They're melodramas, but they're comments on melodramas. They're comments on American materialism, on the American family. They're brilliant, sort of subversive films that are also, they also deliver as so-called women's films, and you're in tears by the end. They're fascinating films, and now taken critically seriously in a way that
they show up on TCM and they're well received. Now you focus on the 50s. We always talk about the golden age of movies, 1939 always given as an example. When you look at the list, 10 movies nominated for Oscars, every one of them under Gone with the Wind, brilliant. What were any great movies coming out in the 50s?
Any great movies? There are more great movies from that decade than any other.
Name them. I can think of Place in the Sun and From Here to Eternity. That's my
Sunset Boulevard, All About Eve, On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, Ben-Hur, Singing in the Rain, Sudden Fear.
So how do you explain that? The industry was collapsing as you, and yet great pieces were coming out.
Great films were coming out. The system was in decline. It would be dead by the mid to late 60s, completely finished. Under attack, the audience wasn't there in the same numbers as it had been in the 30s and the 40s. Everything coming apart. And I would argue, and I do in the book, that more great films were produced in this 10-year period than in any other period in American films. And they had the blacklist to contend with.
Yes.
Political tensions. And still, look at all the important films from the period that we still remember and honor. The series at the Film Forum is doing very well, and I'm happy to say it's attracting younger people, too. It's not
well, just they certainly sustain. I've watched them on TCM, Waterfront, and Singing in the Rain is just one. Well, it's a wonderful musical, and All About Eve, of course.
Is there a better movie musical than Singing in the Rain? Tell me, is there a better original movie musical?
Well, I'm very high on Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, but that was also in the 50s, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and that's at the Film Forum, too. Kiss Me, Kate in 3D is a terrific movie. American in Paris, Gigi. It was the end of the era for the original movie musical. After that, it was just adaptations of Broadway successes. It was
you
the
know
end
why,
of
one,
the noir cycle. It was the
one
end
of the things I love about movies in that period that you're talking about, when you mentioned Kiss Me, Kate, Ann Miller does a big dance, and suddenly I said, that's Bob Fosse dancing with her. He was the chorus boy or alongside of her. You constantly see people at the start of their careers that blossom. It's a fascinating part of going to the
old
movies.
In the 50s, you have the ends of the old Hollywood stars, and then you have the new stars coming in. Grace Kelly, Doris Day, Audrey Hepburn, Marlon Brando, James Dean, Montgomery Clift. A whole raft of new players. The method comes in the 50s, a new style of acting. And then you have the old-timers who are sort of phasing out through death or through age. Humphrey Bogart in the 50s, I think, acts more valiantly and better than he had it in his entire career. He had a wonderful six-year run in the 50s. James Stewart sort of reinvented himself in the 50s. Gary Cooper dies at the end of the decade, but gives his greatest performance, I believe, in High Noon. Wonderful. Westerns, don't forget Shane. The Searchers, John Ford's greatest film, I would argue. John Wayne did well in the 50s. So it was a vital period for so many people, those who were on the way out and the newcomers coming in and getting new chances and doing great work.
You talk about those that held on. I mean, the prime example was Betty Davis. They have to reinvent themselves, no longer the leading lady, but who else? Well, you mentioned Stewart and Cooper, but some of them, Davis went way beyond the 50s, didn't she?
But the three great divas of studio era Hollywood, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Katharine Hepburn, had to reinvent themselves in the 50s and beyond, because they all had careers that lasted beyond the post-war decade.
But can I add Stanwyck to that list?
Can you add?
Barbara Stanwyck to that list.
Yes, but she died in the 50s.
She suddenly became the queen of the Westerns.
But she, her film, her major film career ends in 1957, and then she goes to television, which is what happened to a lot of the old stars.
Big Valley?
The Big Valley. And then she only made one or two minor films in the 60s. But her career ends in 1957. And her profile was a little less stellar than the three big divas I mentioned. She's in interesting films, but they're not so well remembered. Witness to Murder, do you remember that? Jeopardy, Crime
yes,
of Passion. They're good films, but they're not A-list films.
That's Stanwyck. So let me ask you this, because I'm so impressed at your everything that you've done in the book, Hollywood and the movies of
Thank you.
50s. Are you often asked, what do you think are the best movies that you've ever seen, your opinion, and the best actors, the best film actors?
In my opinion, the greatest American film actor is Marlon Brando. And I talk about his work in the 50s, which was his best period. But you look, On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire,
yeah.
The Wild One. Don't laugh. He is very good as Napoleon in Desiree. People are supposed to hate that film. He hated it. He gives a terrific performance. Elegant, by the way. He has a British accent as Napoleon. Well, why not?
And he was good in Julius Caesar, too. You have a wonderful story. There's a scene in On the Waterfront when he and Eva Marie Saint are going across a park, and she drops a glove, and he puts it on. And you explain that's a wonderful story of an, I guess Kazan just said, keep it in. It could have ended up not in the movie.
She drops her glove. They were rehearsing. It was a mistake. She drops her glove. And he picks it up. Most actors would just simply hand it back to her. But what he does is he puts the glove on his hand, because his intention in the scene is to hold her there. He's sort of courting her. He's attracted to her. And so he holds her there by putting the glove on his hand. She can't leave. It was an instinctive gesture. And Kazan said, keep it in. It was a brilliant choice. There's another choice that Brando makes that shows his genius in the famous taxicab scene with Rod Steiger.
Mm-hmm.
His brother, played by Rod Steiger, points a gun at him. Most actors would simply shove the gun away. He almost caresses the gun, it's as if he's embracing his brother.
What was his brother's name? Was it Joey? He says, and then he says his brother's name as he dismisses
Charlie.
It.
Oh, Charlie. You should have taken better care of me. I could have been a contender instead of a bum, which is what I am. The greatest scene of self-recognition in American movies.
It's a beautiful scene. What women and other male actors and other women do you put at the top?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that, David.
What women? Brando is your favorite male actor. Are there other men, and who are the women that you think are the great?
James Dean. I think the method actors that come in the 50s are terrific movie actors. They have a wonderful sense of intimacy, an inner life. Their eyes reveal a kind of inner monologue and a sense of privacy.
I never got Dean. What about Spencer Tracy and Paul Muni? Do they fit into your?
They're from an older style. Spencer Tracy had a very strong persona, and he seemed like such a natural. Kazan didn't think much of him or of Katharine Hepburn. He thought they were doing old style movie star acting, which was not what he was interested in. But Spencer Tracy has a real strength on screen. But they're from an older school, Paul Muni.
Yeah. You know, of the modern actors, the one who always gets me is Denzel. And not Hurricane particularly, but also in Philadelphia, which is a Tom Hanks got the Oscar. As the second guy, he is incredible. He reaches out in a way that very few actors of today do on screen.
Yeah, he's terrific. Absolutely. He's a wonderful actor.
What about the women? Who are the great women of screen for you?
There are two kinds of women in the 50s. Let's not ignore Marilyn Monroe, who was terrific and who was sort of one of a kind. She was a great natural with wonderful comic timing, but she could also do dramatic acting.
I've never heard her put in that category of great screen actresses, but go ahead.
Oh, I think she's terrific. You know,
I loved her, but I would have never thought of putting her along with Davis and Lily Palmer and the women that I loved in the movies.
Look at her playing opposite Laurence Olivier in The Prince and the Showgirl. Her comic timing, her instincts, she holds her own on the screen with the greatest actor of his generation.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
and what movie, if you will list your two or three greatest movies of all time, what are they?
The greatest movies of all time?
Yeah.
My two favorites of the 50s are Imitation of Life and On the Waterfront. I think those are my two personal favorites, and I would make a case for them as great movies. I once hosted a screening of On the Waterfront with Eva Marie Saint in person, and I said, now the co-star of the best acted film ever made, On the Waterfront. And when she got to the stage, she said, you just made that up. But I didn't. I think it is the best action film ever made, film I've ever seen.
You know, Forster, one of the things about the movies, there are scenes, you know, in Casablanca, it gets a lot of praise. There's a scene when Ingrid Bergman first and Bogart first sees her while Dooley Wilson is playing on the piano. That's an incredible emotional scene, as is Rod Steiger and Brando in the back of the taxi cab. There are scenes that jump out at you that stay forever.
And what about Celeste Holm? The three greatest scenes
in the car with Betty Davis and All About Eve?
Are enclosed scenes. Betty Davis and Celeste Holm in the car and All About Eve. The taxi cab scene with Brando and Steiger, and the motel room scene in Imitation of Life with Juanita Moore and Susan Conner. As good as those two other scenes. Those are the three best action scenes I've ever seen. Yeah, I'm raving about Imitation of Life. It will be at the Film Forum next Thursday. I'll be introducing an 8 o'clock screening and praising the film to the skies.
Marster, it's always a pleasure. I'm going to thank you so much for joining us. We have a lot of other things to do, but I want to alert everybody about Hollywood and the movies of the 50s. We have some copies, and after we play some Cleo Lane, I'm going to tell them how they can get a copy of your book through VAI and urge them to check the check film forum about when you're going to be there or just those movies of the 50s. It is the book is for anybody that ever fell in love with the movies. I was, you know, I was dumped at the Rialto Theater on Main Street in Richfield Park, New Jersey at 3 because they didn't know what to do with this obstreperous child. And they finally found something that kept me quiet. And every Saturday, I was dumped at the theater. And so...
But you're a big moviegoer, David. You're a big moviegoer to the present moment, aren't you?
Yes. It's like going to... I don't want to watch Netflix. I want to sit in a theater.
Absolutely.
I don't know why. It's almost... And I want it to be quiet, and it's a religious experience. Forster Hirsch, thank you so much for joining. Everybody go down to the film forum and share this moving joy.
I really appreciate your attention. I really do. Thank you.
Thanks, Forster. Let's hear from Cleo Lane singing this beautiful song by Francesca Blumenthal, The Lies of Handsome Men, and then I'll tell you how you can get a copy of Hollywood at the Movies. Hollywood and the Movies in the 50s.
I believe in star signs, and I believe in film romances. I believe in fantasy, and I believe with just one glance, he's crazy for my eyes, 'cause I believe the lie of handsome men. I believe in witchcraft, and I believe in Cinderella. I believe in gypsies, and I believe I cast a spell that sends him to the skies. I believe the lies of handsome men. Somewhere in a corner of my mind, I'm not a fool, completely blind. But even though he's who on his line, I find the pleasures be mine. I believe in love songs, they seem to know just what I'm feeling. I believe Prince Charming, I never guess he's double dealing. How my spirits rise, leaving in the lives of handsome men. expect that happy ending. Wishing on some rainbow. I pretend he's not pretending. Someday I'll get wise. But right now I need the light.
Leo Lane was married to Johnny Dankworth. I don't even know if they're still with us on this, but I think she is. I know he did the arrangement, that beautiful arrangement for Francesca Blumenthal's unique song, The Lies of Handsome Men. The book, Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, available a $50 gift to BAI. It is a biggie. $50 plus, I think, because it's such a big book, we're going to have to charge extra for postage. But anybody who's a film buff, aficionado, or fan, or curious, this is a treasure. You know, Forster has written other books, and I've interviewed him. He wrote one about Otto Preminger, and he did one about, I don't know what else he wrote about. And we talked. He lives in my neighborhood, and we run into each other, and we talk about the movies when we see each other. But this is a triumph. This is I'm sure people in the business will be buying and getting a hold of it. So you can go down to the Film Forum. I'm sure those books will be on sale there as well. But you can get it through BAI and support us. If you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, give your phone number, and then I'll get your address so we can get the book off to you as soon as they're already here. It's not going to be a long wait. Be out in you'll get them within a week, and we'll get you Forster Hirsch's extraordinary. It's a good read. You know, because I liked it so much, because it's so big, I read 3 or 4 chapters, then I'd put it down and say, I got to come back to this, because I didn't want it all at once. It's a feast. And you know, sometimes with a feast, you eat the drumstick and the grapes, like in all those movie epics, and then you take a rest, and then you come back for the coffee and the chocolate mousse cake. That's what this is like. Judge Tanya Chutkan put a gag order on Motormouth, threatening Motormouth being Donald Trump, barring him from public comments, targeting members of the court, targeting Jack Smith and his staff, or any reasonable witnesses. He can campaign on issues facing the nation, but not his criminal court case. You know, he's on his whatever technological thing. He's targeting people. That's threatening. In one of his other court cases, the judge just fined him $5,000. That's like fining me a quarter. That doesn't deter him. And he's crying First Amendment because he's running for president. Donald Trump, you can campaign on all the issues, but no defendant other than you would possibly get away with threatening people involved in their case, the prosecutors, the witnesses. That's dangerous. It's life-threatening. And that's not a violation of your First Amendment. That's protecting the lives of other Americans. And how dare you run for president with such an ignorance of not knowing the difference between the First Amendment and attacking people within our criminal justice system. You're a stupid, ignorant man. What a disgrace you are to this country. How do you really feel about him, David? Let's get you to the theater in case you just tuned in. Tickets for Eisenhower, John Rubenstein in his final week. We have tickets Monday night, Monday at 7, Thursday at 5, Friday at 7, and next Saturday and Sunday matinee. John Rubenstein as Dwight Eisenhower in a play that gives you much political insight and human insight. And as I said earlier, I've had a half a dozen listeners taking me to task for celebrating Eisenhower. I'm celebrating the play, and I'm celebrating, and I'm calling attention to the fact that the theater illuminated me about things in that period in which I lived that has a direct effect on our lives today. And I find the theater as an agent of social reflection and social change important. And to see an actor of the quality of John Rubinstein on an off-Broadway stage in New York is a treat. So it's $50 for a for a pair of tickets to Eisenhower this week. If you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, give you a phone number, and let's hear from Fats Waller, and hope you order the book. And Fats, sing to me. We're going to hear from Fats. Mr. Jacobs, is he on the way? Well, I'll keep talking till Fats comes along. The book by Foster Hirsch is $50, and I would hope that you would take advantage of this great offer, and it's a way of supporting listener-sponsored BAI.
On Broadway that pays my back house dues, you know? And I can't kid no more. Hold everything, but here's a couple of them from the show. There's a gal in my life, and you're slightly less than wonderful. Look out now. There it is, yeah.
Fats Waller here on Saturday morning. Well, the shoes are dropping down in Georgia in the trial there. Sidney Powell, who's nuts. She has copped a plea and she'll probably testify. And yesterday, Kenneth Cheeseborough, one of the other attorneys. So that's two down, 16 to go, who'll probably be testifying against Donnie T. Let's have a guess. Who's the biggie? I think Mark Meadows. I don't think he wants to do time, and I don't think he's devoted to Donald Trump. And Donald will find that loyalty is not universal. I wonder, you know, Sidney Powell, when she gave her original testimony in behalf of Trump, said she famously got her information from someone who got it from the wind and from dead people. I mean, that's what was going on. That's how absurd it was. So I wonder if El Nino and Thomas Paine reached her over the weekend and got her to cop a plea. Trump has surrounded himself by lunatics. Will Rudy G open up? Interesting what's happening there. By the way, last week I played a wonderful song by Lou Rawls called If I Were a Magician. And I said that the CD only attributed the creator of the song as B. Vera. And I didn't, you know, why didn't the CDs give full names? And then I got an email from Richard Barr, who used to host a program. And he said, told me that Billy Vera, who wrote that song, used to host a program on WBAI. Ain't that of interest to you? You think? I do. So is anybody calling for the book? Does anybody want to go to the theater? Does anybody want to support BAI? Ode to the Wasp Woman with Sean Penn starring. Tickets starting next Monday. We have Monday the 30th. Not this week, but following Monday. And then Thursday, November 2nd. And then Sunday matinee, November 5th. That's Sean Young. And it's a play with about four people who were B players in the movies. Alfalfa, George Reeves, Barbara Payton, and Susan Cabot. Do you remember any of those people? They were very prominent in that period that Foster was talking about. They were B movie players, and they made a living at it. And somebody's written a play about what happens to people who lived. It's a homage to that period, those actors who were punchlines and jokes, not taken seriously, but made a living. Remember George Reeves as Superman with his little pot belly? Fascinating. So if you want to see Ode to the Wasp Woman, it's coming to the Actors Temple, not this week, but the following week. And we have tickets for three different performances. And then in the second week of November, we have tickets. So I invite you to celebrate that and for you to get to the theater and email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Let's hear from, I guess we'll go out, Mr. Jacobs, with this, with Mary Clear Heron. That'll be our final song for today. I'm on Monday with the young actor who's playing Lenny Bruce in the trial of Lenny Bruce. And then next Saturday, I'll be here with Stanley Richards. Mary Clear, say goodbye through songs for us. Everybody, thank you for joining me this morning, and have a good weekend. Looks like it's drying up. Mary Clear.
A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's the rest of the stump, it's a little alone. It's a sliver of glass, it is life, it's the sun. It is night, it is death, it's a track, it's a gun. The oak when it blooms, a fox in the brush. The knot in the wood, the song of a thrush. The wood of the wind, a cliff, a fall, a scratch, a lump. It is nothing at all, it's the wind blowing free. It's the end of the slope, it's a beam, it's a void. It's a hunch, it's a hope, and the riverbank talks at the waters of March. It's the end of the strain, it's the joy in your heart. The foot, the ground, the flesh and the bone. The beat of the road, a slingshot stone. A fish, a flash, a silvery glow. A fight, a bet, the range of the bow. The bed of the well, the end of the line. The dismay in the face, it's a loss, it's a find. A spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a drip, a drop. The end of the tale, a truckload of bricks in the soft morning light. The shot of a gun in the dead of the night. A mile, a must, a thrust, a bump. It's a girl, it's a rhyme, it's the cold, it's the mumps. The plan of the house, the body in bed and the car that got stuck. It's the mud, a float, a drift, a flight, a wing, a hawk, a quail. The promise of spring and the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart. A snake, a stick, it is John, it is Joe. It's the thorn in your hand and the cut in your toe. Stroke of knife, a pin, a needle, a sting, a pain, a snail, a riddle, a wasp, a stain. A pass in the mountains, a horse and a mule, through the distance the shelves, with three shadows of blue. And the riverbank talks of the waters of
promise of life in your heart, a stick, a stone, the end of the road, the rest of the stump, a lonesome road, a sliver of glass, a life, a sun, a night, a death, the end of the run, and the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart.
Okay, now you got a pitch.
Ask for money for WBAI?
Damn straight. You got to ask for money for WBAI, and you got to get people to give it, because you are now in charge of publicity and promotion, and if you don't get people to donate, we got to fire you.
So, I have to tell everyone that WBAI listener-supported free speech radio, truth and justice radio, radio for the 99.5% on 99.5 FM, is the best radio station in New York City, the only truly listener-supported station in New York City, and they should contribute to WBAI, become WBAI buddy members. And if they don't?
Then we gotta fire you.
You can't fire me.
Why?
Because I'm just a volunteer. WBAI doesn't have enough money to hire somebody to do publicity and promotion.
So what do we do instead?
How about a silly conversation like this that we can broadcast on the air and say, please support Peace and Justice, Free Speech Radio, radio for the 99.5% at 99.5 FM. Contribute. Become a WBAI buddy member.
Do you think this war will ever end?
I don't know. They'll just have another one.
I want to get out of here. Don't you?
Not that much.
So you like it here?
It's not that bad.
You're in a foxhole. What a war raging outside.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org. Now, do it now.
Don't want to use the website or the call center to contribute to WBAI? That's okay. Please feel free to send your check or money order to WBAI, 3rd floor, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Please